Well, we're going to talk about the climactic battles of the judges. Every one of those climactic battles represents another aspect or another detail about Armageddon, each from a different perspective. But together, it shows us quite convincingly there is nothing that the Lord God cannot overcome. The first we'll talk about, some will argue, well, Joshua was not really one of the judges. He preceded the judges. But nevertheless, it goes along with the judges, and he was the first one to have a climactic battle in the land. We start out at Jericho. We'll recall that there were seven priests with seven trumpets marching around Jericho 7 days. Well, it shows us the gospel age divided into seven periods of time, suggesting to us, this is my suggestion, and you are each entitled to your own understanding of it. You are entitled to your own view, and everyone is entitled to mine. So the first part, I would say, is under the Jews up to 69 A.D., the second under pagan Rome up to about 312 A.D. and Constantine, and then under imperial Rome, supposedly Christian Rome, up to somewhere between the 450s and 538 A.D., then under papal Rome until the Reformation. The Reformation starts probably 1517 with the 95 Theses, and then I'll suggest that we had the period of Protestant expansion that would start in the French Revolution about 1799 until Christ's second presence. I can maybe suggest we talk about the 1870s to begin it, but I can't quite give you the date to end it. Perhaps someone is wiser than I. Now, the experience of Joshua at Jericho starts with Joshua rose early on the first day. Anybody know the name Jehoshua, what it means? We start with Hoshea, that's salvation. Jehoshea, oh, Jehovah is salvation. And what's the Greek form of the name Joshua? That's right. So, is it any surprise that Joshua typifies Jesus? And Joshua rose early on the first day would suggest Jesus' resurrection begins the gospel age of the church. And then we have these 7 days going around Jericho until the wall falls down. But it's interesting that the seventh day begins with, and they rose early on that seventh day. What might that suggest to us? Well, Christ at his return resurrects the church that have already finished their courses. And so they rose early on the last day. We have lots of last day scriptures, don't we? And then when that begins, of course, there's a period of time until we get to the wall falling down and the church complete and Babylon collapsing altogether. 7 times they went around Jericho on the last day. I think that would suggest to us the 7 last plagues of Revelation. So let us think what this explains for us in the book of Revelation. 7 days they marched around the city with the 7 trumpets. Well, that seems like it ought to fit pretty well the Revelation chapters 8 through 11, the seven trumpets, and I think it does well. And then, if that's the case, might that also parallel the seven seals in chapters 6 and 7? And how about the seven churches of chapters 2 and 3? Add to that Revelation chapter 16, Joshua at Jericho explains for us 9 of the 22 chapters of Revelation. Not bad for a single type, is it? So, now we come to the book of Judges. And the first judge that we might talk about is Ehud. That's, you can see, perhaps, in Judges 3:17, the important part. And that is that the king of Moab there is really just plain fat. He is opulently rich. And evidently it appeared on his breakfast table as well. So, we can understand by that, in trying to identify Babylon, we would look for an institution which is just opulently rich, filthy rich, whatever you like to call it. Now we go to Deborah and Barak. That's Judges chapters 4 and 5. Maybe stress chapter 4, verse 13. Now, this is a case where the Sisera and his chariots are going to come after Israel. Now, Deborah and Barak are up on Mount Tabor. And to the south of them, there is a river. That's one of the biggest rivers, really, in Israel that goes out to the sea. And Sisera and his hosts were at the west end of that valley where it narrows down. And so Sisera and his hosts come up the stream on the south side of the stream, and then they cross over the stream. And that's a case where Deborah was just waiting for the right opportunity. Those that were on the south side of the stream were also on the north side of Mount Carmel, and they couldn't see the clouds coming. But Deborah, from her habitation up here on Mount Tabor, could see it clearly that the clouds were coming. And so here you have 900 chariots of iron. Think about trying to resist 900 trucks coming at you. But what happened? Well, you can just see Sisera saying, okay, they're coming down. I'm going to meet them. I've got them right where I want them. Oh, blankety blank, rain. What was it that destroyed Pharaoh's 600 chariots? It was water. So here, Sisera's 900 chariots get bogged down in the rain, enough so that he himself had to get off his chariot and run for it. So, we have a lesson here, and that is the Lord knows how to defeat these most serious high-tech that this world can come up with. After all, what happened this April 13th? I'll mention another one. Experience at the county fair 10 years ago this year. We had some Jewish ladies selling something on the left of us, and so I asked one of them, do you know about that missile that was launched from Gaza about a month ago, and it was headed straight for the defense ministry in Tel Aviv, and they sent up an Iron Dome interceptor after it, and it missed. Now, they almost never miss. They're 90%+ reliable, but it missed. They sent up a second one, and it missed. and a third one, and it missed. And when the situation looked hopeless, the wind suddenly blew it into the Mediterranean. She said, "Yes, I know about that missile. And my mother works in that defense ministry, and she would have been killed." That certainly took the breath out of me. But maybe an hour later, I asked one of the others, "Do you have any feel for why those three interceptors all missed?" And she says, "I think the Lord was telling us he's in charge." Oh, yes, and Russell Wojcik clipped a little item about the same incident from the Los Angeles Times. And it was about a journalist interviewing the Palestinian in Gaza. And he says, "Why don't you aim your missiles better?" "We do aim them, but their God keeps blowing them away." So, the lesson of Deborah and Barak. God knows how to completely defeat high tech. And he sure did. Now we come to Gideon. You could look at Judges chapter 8, maybe verse 10. Here we have 135,000 of the enemy troop. Now there were only initially, something like 25,000 of the Israelites, and it was too many. So 15,000 of them were dismissed, and down to 10,000, still too many. It was reduced to just 300. So what happened? The Lord told them how to do it, that you've got this river to the south, and they're on the north side of the river, and you've got these two hills on the east side and the west side. So the only ways of escape for the 135,000 were either upstream or downstream or up between the two hills. So it tells us that Gideon's army was to be divided into three camps, roughly 100 each then. We can understand why, to block all the exits. And I guess we don't need to go into the detail here, but God, with those 300, was able to defeat 135,000. So if the Lord has shown us how he can defeat high tech, he can also show us how to defeat multitudes upon multitudes. Hopeless odds. Well, it was a nighttime battle. So you can just sort of see it here, how the camp of the enemy was here. And so you've got each of the three exits blocked by the Israelites. And each one of them, they broke their pitchers. That must have been quite a clatter. And then their lights shone. Well, that's a lesson for you and me. We have to break our vessels, sacrifice self for our lights to shine. And when they did, and they were blowing the trumpets, you can imagine the people who are on the edge of the Midianite camp, how the first thing they were going to do is run away from it. But to those who are all maybe part way in, what they see is the captains of hundreds, and here's this army rushing in at night, and so they must be the enemy. They destroyed one another. Now, I think I'll deviate a little bit from my thoughts here. When we have Gideon and these three enemies, Jehoshaphat in the time of the kings also had three enemies. But it gives us a little piece of information in addition to what Gideon's three enemies give us. With Jehoshaphat, the enemy was Ammon to the north, Moab to the center, and the inhabitants of Mount Seir to the south, the land of Edom. And So when the Lord's people began to sing praises unto Jehovah, or Yahuwah would perhaps be better, then it was that the Lord sent liers in wait against the enemy. And what happened? Well, the Ammonites and the Moabites ganged together to destroy the inhabitants of Mount Seir. And then, when they completely destroyed the inhabitants of Mount Seir, they proceeded to destroy one another. If we were to look today and see what is happening, there are three big ideologies in the world today. What we might call Christendom, Rome sort of acting as the head, and Islam, and also Marxism, communism, whatever you want to call it. And I think what I see is that Islam and communism or Marxism are ganging together to completely destroy Christianity. But once they've done that, then they will go to destroying one another. So that's added on to the information of Deborah and Barak. Now, next after him, and I'm not sure that this is quite so much intended, in chapter 9, we see Abimelech, who seizes power. But in his seizing of the power, I won't go into details here, it didn't last very long, because there was a woman that dropped a millstone on his head. And, oh well, yes, that's it, it fell. So he wanted to have somebody else kill him. But Babylon shall be cast down as a millstone? Might think about that. Okay. So, this is a case where the enemy may be able to seize power in this time of Christ's second presence, the harvest of the gospel age. But it won't last before the one seizing power also destroys himself. Then we have Jephthah in chapter 11. Now, Jephthah was cast out from among his brethren until suddenly they needed him. And then he was recalled in order to save Israel. And when might that happen? That might be when the ancient worthies are raised. And I should suppose that would be early in Armageddon in order to deliver Israel from Armageddon. Now, we come to Samson. Well, remember that he was taken captive, and his wife, I guess, had shaved his head. Bad mistake. So he was kept as a prisoner until his hair was starting to regrow. And then it was that he was being brought out to sport. Is this to happen to the true church during this time? That could be. But in the end, Samson asks the Lord, and he is able to push out the pillars of the temple, which comes crashing down on the enemy. That would suggest to us that the faithful church will be completed just as Armageddon begins. There's also a suggestion of that in Revelation chapter 16, when the last plague is poured out. What's the first thing that happens? There's a voice that says, "It is done," like our Lord's words on the cross, "It is finished." So I don't think we should allow anyone to close the door on us before the church is complete. And those, I think, are our lessons concerning the climactic battles of the judges. But now another thing that is pertinent to us is Ezekiel chapter 38. If we choose to go to Ezekiel chapter 38, we could also keep our fingers in Genesis chapter 10. In verses 1 through 6 here, we have a whole bunch of different nations. Well, who are those different nations? The Eastern Bloc is to be headed by Gog and Magog. So who are they? I would suggest before giving rationale for it that Magog has a whole lot of sub-tribes to it, the largest of which is the Great Russians, but it includes the Uzbekis, the Kazakhs. Incidentally, I worked with a fellow named Boris Kazakh, and he explained the meaning of the word Kazakh. It's free man. And then the Mongols. Lamza, in his translation from the Aramaic, sometimes translates Magog as Mongol. Well, you do see a characteristic of the Mongols, a very oval-shaped head. That's in common with the Samoyed tribes in the north of Russia, on eastward through the Yakut, even into the Eskimos of Alaska. Then also the Koreans. In their lore or history, they came out of Mongolia. Now, in ancient times, these people were known as the Sakata, which we call the Scythians. That helps to explain the strange spelling. Maybe I shouldn't go on to a little side trip here, but I'll do it anyway. In the Hebrew language, you have a word, sagab, a verb which means to lift up. And the Gog is that which is lifted up. So, Gog means the high people. But also, while we have Gog in the Western languages, the Eastern form of it in the Eastern languages is Saka. Hence, Saka Ta, the Saka hordes, the Scythians. And if you look in Herodotus, he speaks of the Ma Sageti, the Ma Saka Ta. The Ma means going out from the Saka hordes. And of course, he's talking about the Scythians or the Great Russians at that time. Now we come down to two more tribes here that are under it, Meshech and Tubal. Well, the Magog tribe, or the Great Russians, winds up as part of Christendom, the Orthodox side of Christendom. But Meshech and Tubal were also Christian at earlier times, even than the Great Russians. The Meshech are the Armenians. A prominent city of them was Kayseri Mazaka, meaning Caesarea of Meshech. And Tubal, well, we call them Georgians. The Slavs call them Grusians. They themselves call themselves Kartvelians, the Kara Tubal, the rocks of Tubal. Now, in Georgian, the word Tubal means warm, and it's named because of the hot springs that they have in what used to be Soviet Georgia, now independent Georgia. Their capital is Tbilisi, again, the same root. So it's not difficult to see who they are. An interesting characteristic of them is that they tell the truth, and they expect you to tell the truth. If a Georgian tells you something, you can believe that he believes it fully, and he has no doubts about it. I could give some examples, but won't take time for that now. Next nation is Persia. That's Iran. Iran is a good name for a country people want to get out of in a hurry. For 25 centuries, they were mortal enemies of the Russians. Because King Cyrus, well, he was able to kill in battle the son of the queen of the Russians, or the Scythians. In turn, she massed an army, and she was the only one that had been able to conquer and then kill Cyrus. For 25 centuries, they had been mortal enemies until 1979. In the modern era, the scripture of Ezekiel 38 couldn't be fulfilled until 1979 when the Shah was overthrown. For what it's worth, Shah, what's the derivation? Well, we start with Caesar, German Kaiser. In Russian, the Tsar. And in Persia, the Shah. All the same word. Then there's Kush. That's sub-Saharan Africa. And it's not just Ethiopia, but going south along the Nile and then west towards West Africa, all that territory was known as Kush. And Put, that's North Africa, everywhere west of Egypt. And those are territories taken over by Arabs. So that's why they're distinguished from Kush. Now we come to Gomer. Herodotus and the Bible agree that it was the Scythians or the great Russians that divided the tribe of Gomer or Kimmer into three. First Ashkenaz, the Germanic tribes, then Riphath, the Kara Riphath, the Carpathian Mountains. That is the mountains of Riphath. Both of those became Christian, part of Christendom. And then Togarma, that's different. Well, that's Thorgama in the Septuagint, from which we get our word Turk, including not only Turkey, but when they went east into Turkmen SSR or Turkestan. And the Uyghurs would all qualify as them. They are separated here from Gomer because they became Muslim, whereas both the Ashkenaz, Scandinavia, and the Riphath, the Slavic peoples together, are still part of Christendom. Now, the Armenians and the Georgians are sort of quite unwillingly so influenced by the Russians. Persia, with the fall of the Shah, changed sides from the Western Bloc to the Eastern Bloc. The Russians and the Chinese are gaining influence throughout much of Africa, that's Kush and Put. Turks are in the process of abandoning the West for the East. And that's interesting because over half a millennium, they have been at odds with the Russians. But it is changing, just as it has already for Iran. So it is here for the Turks. We want to watch now for the Germanic and Slavic nations to do likewise. This seems most likely to be happening in our time. Now in Ezekiel 38:13, the Western Bloc is to be headed by Sheba and Dedan. Well, that corresponds to Arabia. It speaks secondarily of the merchants of Tarshish, that'd be the Celtic countries or Celtic countries of westernmost Europe. And then there are the young lions of Tarshish. They would be the Americas, and perhaps including Australia, New Zealand, we may see. Now, it does say in verse 13, their objection is, Art thou come to take a spoil? Years ago, George Steinbeck pointed out, it doesn't say, art thou gone to take a spoil, but art thou come to take a spoil, implying that they have a prior involvement with Israel at that time. At present, the West does seem to have a degree of involvement with Israel. And one good reason is the pipeline from Kuwait and Iraq and Saudi Arabia to get to the Mediterranean and hence the Western world goes through Israel. So yes, it does make sense. But it does suggest then that while they will cooperate with Israel, but they'll nevertheless be unable to help them when Gog comes down. And perhaps Ezekiel 39:6 gives us the reason for it. And that is that I will pour fire on Gog and on the isles of the Gentiles. First on Gog, because Gog is the invading force, stronger. The only defense the West will have is the possibly last nuclear alternative. I will pour fire on Gog, but then Gog will return the favor on the West. And it won't be in Israel that the major threat to the Russians will be, or to the West for that matter. So that is what we may watch to see. And while we're not there yet, these blocks are still forming. Let's see, I think, yes, we can go on now to the last slide. Okay. Seems to be a rather blank slide, or does it? Yeah. Let's see. There should be... Okay, I guess maybe that is the last slide. I apologize for that. Well, we're not there yet. We're still watching those blocks forming. But we need to be very cautious of those who use scare tactics, because God has not given us the spirit of fear. So if he hasn't, which one has? And keep on preaching the gospel age. That's right. Always preach the gospel. Use words when necessary.